I'm Dr. Yosefa Fogel-Rubel. This is a podcast episode brought to you by Matan Women's Institute for Torah Study. Welcome back to our special Pesach-related episode of the Matan podcast, making sure that every week of your year is filled with another installment of these beloved Torah-centered conversations. Before we begin, I want to remind you that sponsoring a podcast is a wonderful way to mark any occasion. Please write me at podcast@matan.org.il or check out the donation webpage of the Matan website. We still have several Vayikra episodes available for sponsorship. Today's guest, Dr. Alana Stein-Hain, is the Rosh Beit Midrash and a senior research fellow at the Shalom Hartman Institute of North America, where she serves as lead faculty and consults on the content of lay and professional programs. A widely well-regarded thinker and teacher, Alana is passionate about bringing rabbinic thought into conversation with contemporary life. To this end, she hosts Texting, a bi-weekly podcast that considers issues relevant to Jewish life through the lens of classical and modern Torah texts. She also teaches Talmud from the Balcony, an occasional learning seminar exposing the big ideas, questions, and issues motivating rabbinic discussions, and also contributes to For Heaven's Sake, a bi-weekly podcast with Danielle Hartman and Yossi Klein-Alevi, exploring contemporary issues related to Israel and the Jewish world. Ilana hosts a weekly shiur for the Hadron website called Din and Daf, which is a conceptual halachic shiur based on the Daf Yomi. Ilana is the author of Circumventing the Law, Rabbinic Perspectives on Legal Loopholes and Integrity, published by Penn Press from 2024, which uses loopholes as a lens for understanding rabbinic views on laws and ethics, and it is the occasion of this book publication that brings Ilana to the Matan podcast today. If you want to order the book, you can visit the Penn Press website and you can receive a 30% discount with the code that we have pasted in the show notes. Alana Stein-Hain, it is an absolute pleasure and honor to be sitting back with you today. I didn't mention that you also were in the past on the Matan podcast where we spoke about Tzaraat. That was actually one of my favorite episodes.
By the way, it was this week.
Oh my goodness, 2 years ago.
Meaning we're about to have Parsha Metzorah. And I think we did Tzvira Metzorah.
We did. You spoke about the Rambam's perspective on Tzaraat. I remember that. It was such a great episode.
Yes.
So that's a callback. Anybody who wants to listen to that episode can go there. But today we're here to speak about something totally different. And I would also say a little bit out of my comfort zone, as we're not speaking biblically. We're speaking very in the rabbinic world that you so much love to swim in. So it's a real, real, real pleasure to be here with you today to speak about this book, which I also just want to say that I remember years ago when I would see you without really knowing you yet in the Stern Beit Midrash. And I think it was then that you were actually working on this doctorate. Is that possible?
It is absolutely correct. This is like people say to me, oh, it's like having a baby. I said, nope, it's like marrying off your child who's 20 years old. It's great.
Baruch it's also Hashem. Really inspiring to know that we can shelve something for a very long period of time and then birth it or marry it off, as you said, when we're ready to. That's very inspiring, to be honest.
It's really true.
Before we sort of get into the details of the book, I also just want you to start with explaining to us a little bit what drew you to this topic within the vast corpus of rabbinic literature.
Totally, totally, totally. Well, first of all, I really just want to thank you so much, Yosefa. This podcast in general, it's such high level. It's so interesting. It's a really spreading Torah to people on a weekly basis that is just so magnificent. And it is great, great, great to be here. I also want to say that as of 2 days ago, Iran's threat was looming in a very serious way. And it is just great to be talking
indeed.
Right now about something that has nothing to do with war, something that has nothing to do with ballistic missiles, something that has to do with just Torah plain and simple and trying to deal with people's needs. So what drew me to the topic of loopholes, I would say, is twofold. The first is, ever since I was a little kid, and I say this at the beginning of the book, ever since I was a little kid, Mechirat Chametz just had me baffled. I was sort of like, what are we doing? I mean, literally, we do our Bedikat Chametz, we do our Bir Chametz, and I have cereal. I have Cheerios in the closet that I'm going to get back after Pesach. So I was like, what is happening? So like ever since I was a little girl, I was definitely intrigued by it. And I would say I also probably used a lot of loopholes. Like one of my earliest loopholes that I remember is my mom telling me that I couldn't read after lights out. So I used to play Game Boy in my, if anybody remembers Game Boy, I used to play Game Boy in my room under my covers. And I remember my mom coming in one day and she says, are you reading? after lights out, I said, no, I'm not reading. And I actually pulled the covers to show her that I wasn't reading, and out flew the Game Boy. And my mom says to me, Alana, I said, what, Aiden? What? I was right. So the limits of loopholes also, I think it's interesting. And it comes up all the time with kids, I think. I will say it comes up all the time. It's April 15th when we are recording this. It's my tax day, literally. You know, what can I get backdated to work out? What can I write off as a this or a that? Right? That kind of thing. And we are a week before my Figure Out Come meets. So that's one thing. I think the second thing is living in the 20th and 21st century, there are many questions about halachic change. When to make it, when not to make it, how to make it, who's authorized to make it. And I think one of the things that's so interesting about circumventions, legal circumventions, is that they model a sort of yes and approach that doesn't throw out the baby mm-hmm. with the bathwater. It doesn't say, okay, we're not doing this anymore because of X reason. And it also doesn't say, well, too bad, we're staying where we were. But it really tries to hold the value of the halachic system in tension with the values of people needing to live, right? And I find that so inspiring in a time where people love to just either mm-hmm. or it. I say, nope, yes, and that's actually the only way the halachic system is going to be able to survive and thrive and people in it. So that's really where my interest stems from.
Yeah, I love that. I think two thoughts sort of come up for me. The first is that in a world that has made halacha primary and rabbinic discourse the backdrop or the background, we really, if you're not studying Talmud or like the process of halachic development, it's so easy to not know that the halachic roots are exactly what you're saying, right? It's the yes and, and that there's such a breadth of a plethora of ideas of development. For me, I love learning halacha because I love the history, which is pretty similar to why people end up also loving Talmud, meaning it's not just a way of thinking, but it's also the multiplicity of ideas. And I think that it's not even just that we live in a simplified world, but even in a Jewish world and even in a learned Jewish world, if you're not sort of deeply embroiled in learning all of our, like the backdrop of all of what we actually do, it's just easy to miss that because the way the halachic books are written just are meant to be clear. They're meant to give clear instructions. And so in order to make things clear for people, it ends up looking binary. And I think that one of the great things that your book does, which is clearly for an educated audience, but I think does a really, really, really phenomenal job at still trying to be clear, for even for somebody who's not coming with that background, is to really showcase that. It's to showcase that like these were issues that Chazal in all different generations and different areas, and we'll get into the weeds of that. But they were struggling with these ideas also of like, how do I look at the world I'm actually living in and make these ideas applicable?
Well, one of the things that's so interesting, Yosefa, is that there's a chapter where I talk a lot about Agadot, a lot about Midrash Agadah, narrative mm-hmm. Midrash, in which a biblical personality, a Moshe, an Avraham, is engaging and negotiating with Hashem about mm-hmm. loopholing, whether this is the right loophole, should it be used, shouldn't it be used? And I think sometimes being able to dramatize it in that way, even for people who are not in the legal mindset, but just the experiential, right? The experience of negotiation is something I think we can all relate to. And the question of when negotiation is you're being a nudnik and you're trying mm-hmm. to undermine, and when negotiation is you're desperately trying to keep the integrity of all of this at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, it even makes me think about, you know, when people, again, I'm just jumping in for a minute to the halachic world. When someone asks a question, so there's often like conversation between, you know, just thinking as the Otzad Halacha and different roles, like, you know, rabbinic kind of roles, we'll say if somebody's asking a question about it, they're clearly already, this is a very primal value for them, meaning there's a respect inherent in just voicing one's question or wish to sort of find some space to live in, meaning just expressing those ideas is already sort of a testament to how much somebody is deeply engaged and committed to them. And I feel like that's also part of what you're expressing. You know, I just actually want us to sort of lay out some of the terms that you use in the book. You spend a lot of effort really trying to help us understand the difference between a legal loophole and a legal fiction. I guess we'll talk about those before, perhaps that makes sense to you, before we talk about the actual term ha'arema.
Sure. So if you're driving, just don't focus on what I'm saying too much. But if you're not driving, then go for it. It goes like this. A legal fiction is something everybody knows is not true. And yet we say, for legal purposes, we treat it that way. Everybody knows that a string around the community, or a tzurat ha-petach, right, a doorway looking, is not a real wall. We all know that. And yet for legal purposes, we treat it that way. A legal loophole is you actually have to make some change, some legal change. So you know what? You actually have to do schirat reshut. You actually have to rent this area of land from the local municipality or whatever you would call it in order to make it a single reshut. There you've actually rented something. Yeah, you've rented it for very cheap, but you've actually done it. So that's really the difference between the two. But I would say they both rely on the ability to be kind of formalistic about the law, because everybody knows socially, okay, so you rented, you know, I rented the Upper West Side from the local municipality so that it could belong to the Jews who are Shomer Shabbos. What are the practical ramifications of that besides for Eruv? There's no social ramification, right? And similarly, there's no real ramification of treating a tzurat ha-petach, treating the structures that we create for Eruv, other than for Eruv itself, right? So from that perspective, they're both relying on a certain formal interpretation of things that isn't necessarily about social ramifications. And I think that's where they get lumped together.
And what is significant about knowing that they're two separate ideas? Meaning, how is that important for us for understanding the ramifications of these ideas?
Well, so it's really interesting. There's a great machloket. There's a great argument. I think I'd say probably between Leib Moskowitz is a big proponent of this. He wrote a book called From Casuistics to Conceptualization. He's a professor at Bar-Ilan. And he basically argues in the book that most of the legal fictions that we see in Chazal are not legal fictions that are trying to get you somewhere. They're not legal fictions that are trying to get you out of a problem, right? Like he gives these examples of, you know, can you consider loaves that are on the top of the lechem hapanim to be as though they're below? Like, these are not things that are getting you out of a jam. And I actually think it's significant to consider that Chazal actually use legal fictions not just to get you out of a jam. They use it because this is actually part of their conceptual tool. So it's not like we would never use this in any other regard, but here, magically, because you need it, we're suddenly using it. And by the way, I would say legal loopholes, similarly, a little bit different, but the whole notion of the process of how you do something, right? If you do it with a shinoi or if you do it without a shinoi, that actually changes the halachic status of it. That also is kind of the roots of the idea of, okay, I'm not allowed to give you a gift, Yosefa, so I'm going to give the gift to somebody else and they're going to give it to you, right? Process matters. So part of the idea is to just know that these are different conceptual tools that Chazal use in different places. It's part of the richness of what Chazal were able to really be explicit about in how you craft a halachic system.
What's interesting, though, is that those tools, as you describe them, are often used in a, I don't know, I guess it's like a lay situation as ways to mock the halachic system. They often become the, I mean, in my house, that was my father's classic, my Alav HaShalom classic joke was like, do everything with a shinoi. Do you know what I mean? Like that, I didn't know that much about the halachic process, but I knew what a shinoi was, you know? And like these, what your book does is to try and illustrate, I think, like the depth and the richness of what these tools are coming to try and do. So it's interesting that in sort of with the test of time, I believe, and we'll go back to some of the details in a moment, they have enabled halachot and the legal system to perpetuate over time, but they also become like the butt of a lot of good jokes and mockery, I would even say, of the halachic system.
Yeah, it's so interesting. On two levels. Number one, I think there's a difference between the outsider's gaze and the insider's gaze, right? when you choose to take on the gaze of the insider, you ask yourself, can I figure out a rhyme or a reason as to how this works? And if I can, then I say, oh, wow, this is a tool. If I'm going to choose the outsider's gaze, and I'm not necessarily going to be able to or want to penetrate what's going on, then I might mock it. But I have to tell you, you might have an insider's gaze and see, ooh, the way this is being applied, it's not being applied right. It's being overused in places it shouldn't be used, and it's being underused in places we desperately need it. And I think that also is a legitimate cause for concern among people. Totally legitimate. And so the second thing I would say, I think it's so interesting, we actually have a Gemara where we have rabbis complaining that some rabbis over there are using for themselves a particular loophole to get them out of certain masrot, out of certain tithes, and they shouldn't be doing that. But it's the loophole that the rabbis themselves opened. Right. But they're basically saying, we trusted them not to use that in that case. They're being exploitative. So that whole conversation is also part of what prompts this, which is, can we find a rhyme or a reason among Chazal where they're going to say, look, Ad Kan, you can't do this here because it's inappropriate. It's not just anything that can pass technical muster, can pass ethical muster. And Lehefech, can we find reasons where we are going to do our best to help you through the letter of this law, right? So part of that is it being exploitative or is it being callous in certain regards? And that causes serious concern as well, right? And that's totally legitimate. That's not just I'm an outsider versus an insider. It's, hey, you're misusing this.
Okay, I actually really want to go back to that in a little bit. But I think before we go further into some specific examples, I'd like you also just to bring in the term now of ha'arema, because I think that it's, you know,
yes,
critical to many chapters of your book. So let's bring in that term and we'll go from
okay.
there.
Okay. Yosefa, we are back to Tanakh. Ha'arama, hey, ayin, resh, mem, hey. It is the term that Chazal use for what seems to be mostly private loopholing. God forbid somebody has a house fire on Shabbos. How do we make sure that they can save more than 3 meals worth of bread, right? How often do house fires happen? Are these like the big issues in the pervasive societal concerns? Generally speaking, not. Why do they use the term ha'arama? Well, interestingly enough, we know that if you look in Bereishit, you're going to find that the Nachash is arum mikol chayat hasadeh. And that's not a good thing. You don't want to be arum. You don't want to be cunning. But if you look in Sefer Mishlei, the whole point of it is latet lepita imorma, to give people who are a little too gullible some prudence, some common sense. And throughout Sefer Mishlei, it's only positive. Only positive. In contrast to things like mizima, which is sometimes positive, sometimes negative. And I think the Chazal choose this term because they're saying, you know what? Sometimes it's Solomonic. Sometimes it's wise. Sometimes it's the Mishlei version. It's exactly what we want to do. It's prudence. And other times it's serpentine. It's nachash-like. You're being exploitative. And I think this stands in sharp contrast to a term that the Romans had for this, which is called fraus legi, legal fraud, which sounds only negative. So it's really interesting to see that develop around the same time, too.
And so how do these phrases, how are they framed in the Yerushalmi and the Bavli? You know, you really lay out really clearly that there are some stark differences between the two different traditions, specifically in regards to this topic. So, and I think it relates to that point you're expressing about how this term can be looked at as serpentine, or it can be looked at as sort of a wise moment of being Solomonic. So how does that manifest? And if you maybe
sure.
you can sort of give it to us with some examples so that we sort of, yeah, know where
totally.
We're going here.
First, I want to just give people some yeah. terms for tax season. Avoidance. That is total legal circumvention of the law for your taxes. Evasion, that is total illegal circumvention of your taxes. It's fraud. Usually we can clearly tell which is which. And then there's a term that was coined called avoision, which as Yiddish as it sounds, is just a combination of the two, which is we're not sure. Is it legal or is it not legal? You have all three categories in Chazal. You have some things where they unanimously say, you can do this. And the example, our opening example in the Mishnah is, you know, Maser Sheni. secondary tithes that you're supposed to eat in Yerushalayim, you have to add a 25% tax if you want to redeem them with money instead of schlepping them to Yerushalayim. What if I don't have that 25% extra to pay? What if I'm not a bigwig? I don't have, and I can't schlep this to Yerushalayim either. And maybe, by the way, we're talking after the Beit HaMikdash when people didn't take their stuff to Yerushalayim, so it's just sitting there, and I have to redeem it. So what do I do? And so the Mishnah says, oh, Ma'arimin Maser Sheni, don't worry. We've got a harama for you. You know what I'm going to do? Give the money to someone else, because you only pay the 25% tax when you redeem it for yourself. If somebody else owns the money, and you own the produce, they can redeem it at its own price. Beautiful, obvious avoidance, okay? How about evasion? Evasion, I would say, in basically every case, when it comes to trying to evade tumah, when it comes to trying to cut some corner, and I want to be careful not to go too far into tumah and tara right now, not just for those who are driving, but for those who are like, I really am not so familiar with tumah and tara. But the idea is that there are times when something only becomes susceptible to tumah when you are planning to use it the way that it is. But if you're not planning to use it yet, it's not susceptible yet. No, what if you say, I'm not planning to use it yet, but in your head, you're planning to use it, right? 10 out of 10, it seems like the mission, the Tosefta really, is just not into it. Evasion, evasion, evasion. We don't know why. Maybe it was trying to be a little bit more machmir about Tumah and Tara. Unclear, but no way, we don't want it. And then you have a case like fire on Shabbos. You usually can take out bread for 3 days' meal, but if you take out gross bread, we'll let you take out nice bread. So there's a machloke. Can you purposely take out gross bread, and then we'll let you take out 3 meals worth of nice bread so that you can save more? Avoidance, right? We're not sure there's a machloke. And when you look at these, what's so interesting is it doesn't say it, but implicitly so much of this is about, and maybe because Tumah and Tara is not so much about this, so much where they allow it or they argue about it is where we're worried that you're going to lose money so often. And when you get to the Yerushalmi, they actually start speaking explicitly that maybe monetary loss is a good enough reason. Maybe helping people avoid an Avera is a good enough reason. But it seems like in those situations, there's some almost principle of the law itself. We don't want people doing Averot. We don't want people losing money, that they're going to help you with a harama. And in the Yerushalmi also, and then I'll pause there because we can talk about the Bavli later, but just to like talk this out a little bit, in the Yerushalmi also, in addition to saying these are the things that permit harama, which seem to be principles from within the law itself, there's also examples of where you can't do it. So you see for the first time in the Yerushalmi a suggestion that there are certain kinds of mitzvot that just can't be circumvented. And it's hard to know exactly what the Yerushalmi means in the specific case, but it seems to be, or at least is later understood by the Bavli to mean, that maybe biblical d'oraita mitzvot can't be circumvented because they're too severe, whereas d'rabbanan mitzvot, rabbinic mitzvot, can be circumvented. And these are the conversations that are happening, but from those conversations, what you see is that Chazal don't just say, okay, you can do it, or okay, you can never do it. They're very wise in trying to think about what are the things that matter to the integrity of the law, both not circumventing things that are too severe because it makes a mockery, and also circumventing specifically in cases where you are worried about principles of the law itself. HaTorah chasa al mamon amshei Yisrael. Torah cares about Israel's money. That's from this coming sweet parsha also. Vitziva kohenu finu et abayit. That before a kohen declares a bayit to be a bayit that has tzara'at, we take everything out of the bayit. And the Mishnah in Negayim, I think it's, I don't know, Perek Yud Bet, Mishnah Zion, says, what are we taking out of the house? What's the big deal? So let everything in the house become tameh. If it's metal, you'll figure it out. Oh, what are we worried about? We're worried about the little pieces of shard pottery that you're going to have to break because you can't make them Torah. Who cares about these little pieces? You know, the Torah cares. HaKadosh Baruch Hu cares. This is from within the halacha and its values itself. And I think that's very, very powerful to see that negotiation in the Yerushalmi.
Are there other, like, sort of deeper ethical ideas that you feel are trying to be preserved? So right now you've mentioned that one is the Torah Chasal Mamonam SheYisrael. Are there other, so what are some of the other ethics that you see coming through in these conversations? I'm calling it an ethic. I don't know if you like that term.
Sure.
A value.
You know what?
A value.
I think it works. I think it works. I think the notion of helping people not commit an avira, it comes up, it's really important. And it comes up in the Bavli also, but comes up in the Yerushalmi already. I think also the concern of people actually being able to have Simchat mm-hmm. Yom Tov, even that is actually really important. And I would say the flip side, the mirror image, is people not exploiting other people. Mm-hmm. So you have examples where the Tosefta will say, we don't want you to exploit someone else using a loophole to take interest. We don't want you exploiting a loophole to cheat a guarantor out of their money, right? So it's those are really, like, if you were to ask me what the deepest ethics are here, it's the deep ethics on the one side of protecting people's money, which essentially is their ability to survive, keeping them from doing averot, which is essentially their ability to keep the mitzvot, and on the other side, keeping them from exploiting other people, right? Those are the ones that come up, all of those, over and over and over again. But you know what, as you're thinking, I also want to say that part of this is it's their way of saying, we want to make sure you can live, which means that different things are going to come up in different cultures, in different moments in history, in different socioeconomic classes, different issues are going to come up. So I take these as somewhat representative of issues rather than only limited, because as we see in the world of takanot, which is not the world of my individual ad hoc situation, but something where Chazal are trying to take into account broad issues that are pervasive for the Jewish people, like not being able to take interest from a fellow Jew, like not being able to collect, you know, money after the Shemitah year that you had lent out to somebody, right? Those things are also about money, which is interesting. But there are moments in time where you realize that if you can't help people figure out a way to do this, then some of our basic survival mechanisms are going to collapse. People giving tzedakah and loans to each other is going to collapse. People being able to make a living is going to collapse. So I don't think it's just money. I think it's the ability to survive and to thrive in a halachic lifestyle.
And your assumption is that these were concerns based on what was actually happening around them, or that they were theoretical concerns that they foresaw with the use of these laws?
Such a great question. Ephraim Urbach, he thinks that the two examples in the Mishnah of Ha'arama, where Chazal seemed to suggest this is what we do. One, the example of Maaser Sheni and saving your 25%, I'm redeeming it. And the other, a situation where you have an animal that is a bechor or is about to be born, and you don't want to have to give that bechor and maybe another animal that you had promised to give as a korban. You don't want to give them both. So in the womb, you say, this animal that's going to be born is that, you know, XYZ korban. So Urbach thinks this is just Chazal responding to what people were doing. He said, people were cutting corners, and Chazal said, you know, gesundheit, cut the corners, because if you don't cut the corners, if we don't let you cut the corners, you're just going to break this completely. And we'd rather you cut corners than otherwise. The reason why I'm not so sanguine about that approach is twofold. Number one, I think you also, there's place to suggest that it's possible that these Mishnayot are post Beit HaMikdash, which means they're living in a time where people are not giving the Bechor as a korban. So it's literally sitting there, useless, right? And there's a whole different way to read that Mishnah as figuring out a way that if this thing became a baal mum and maimed, you'd be able to do something with it. Whereas if you didn't, you wouldn't be able to do anything with it and it's sitting there. Or saving your 25% tax, you're not bringing it. Everybody has to redeem their tithes, right? But even more than that, when you look at the Yerushalmi talks about at least one of these as, you know, they did this ha'arama, and then when people started, well, let me give the example. They did this ha'arama. I'm sitting there, Yosefa, with you at the granary or, I don't know, in a field. And I say, oof, I don't want to redeem my maser sheni because it's going to cost me an extra 25%. Here, Yosefa, take this money and feel free to redeem this produce that belongs to me right here. Not as my shlicha, but just you feel free. So you know what people used to do? The Yerushalmi says, and even the Tosafta says, people would run away with the money, right? So what did they do? They said, okay, so from now on, you know what we're going to do? I'm not going to give you the money because that's easy to take you for you to take away. I'm going to give you the produce. I'm going to give you the produce because you're not going to schlep that produce around. And the Yerushalmi says that even then, people would do bad stuff. Maybe after the redemption happened, you would just eat the fruit instead of giving it back, or maybe even before. So they did even a third thing to try to figure out. So why are they protecting this so much if it's just, you know, we're just kowtowing to what people are doing? It sounds like they're taking a look at what people need and they're saying, let's do our best to make this work. Right? And I think that takes a lot of guts and it takes a certain amount of authority and it takes a certain trust of the people, to be honest. It takes a certain trust of the people. And that's where I think things start to change in the Bavli. The Bavli, a little less comfortable. The Bavli starts talking about how maybe only a tzurba mirabanan, maybe only a scholar, should be able to use certain loopholes. Why? Because they think it's going to lead people who are not scholars to just, like you said, just mock it, right? Just like, and then say, well, if I can do this, then I can do that, and I can do this, and I can do that. Or you see even the term ha'arama, Aramaicized, as lying. Ati li'i'arume. Someone's going to lie, and it's really used as lying, not loopholing. Lying. And I think you even see, you know, there's a kind of ha'arama, which I mentioned it before when it comes to like tumah and tahara, where what's my intention for this object? And what my intention for this object is defines it halachically. So there's two different kinds of ha'arama that you find in Chazal. One is where you make an actual difference externally, right? So that actual difference, I'm going to have to pay 25% extra if I use my own money to redeem my produce. But if you own the money and you redeem produce that I own, you made a real change out there, right? And that's a harama. It's a concrete harama. But there's also harama where it's like your intention is what you're performing, right? So here's a perfect example. It's like it's the parade example, okay, of harama because it's everywhere. It's in Tosefta, it's in Yerushalmi, it's in the Bavli, it's like the parade example. And it goes like this. You've got two animals, it's a mother-child pair, and they fell into a pit on Yom Tov. How are you going to get them
funny,
out?
It's not funny, sorry, it's just funny.
They're mukta. Yeah. No, but it's fun. That look, some of these things, it's like it's supposed to be vivid, right? Yeah. You'll remember it. They're mukta unless you're going to shech them to eat them on Yom Tov, right? That's it, they're mukta. So great. So someone's going to tell me, shechtem. Take him out to shechtem. Well, you can't otoved benolo tishchetu biyom echad. You can't shecht a mommy and a baby animal on the same day. And you also, if you learn chulin, you find out you can't even get a shaliach to do one of them for you. So you're stuck. You can only save one, it looks like. So Rabbi Eliezer says, okay, you're stuck. You can only save one. Rabbi Yeshua is like, no. Take out the first one, al menat l'shochto, in order to slaughter it, and then don't slaughter it once you take it out. You know, it looks a little skinny. Not sure I really want it. And then take out the next one, al menat l'shochto, and also, it looks a little skinny. I don't think I want it. Basof, in both the Tosefta and the Yerushalmi, you have to shecht either of them, right? Now, that kind of harama is like you're enacting certain intention, right? Like that's different than, you know, I hand you money, right? It's different. And so the Bavli in general is much more skeptical of that kind of hierema. It's almost like the inner world, like the inner subjective world of a person becomes that much more important to the Bavli than it was earlier. They're like, look, you got to shecht at least one of them. Like the examples of the Bavli, you have to shecht at least one of them. And time after time, a suggestion will be made about a harama that would be using performed intention. And Chazal are like, or at least later Amarim are like, nope, you got to actually do the thing. Like, you want to set up a strainer on Yontif, which is Uvda Dechol, that's a weekday activity. You can't just say, oh, I intend this to hold rimonim. I intend this to hold, like, to be like a little basket for pomegranates, not to strain it, and then use it as a strainer. No, you have to actually put rimonim in it. You have to actually use it as a basket first. They're not, this idea of intention being performed, very problematic for the Bavli. The whole inner life of the human being, the subjective reality of what's going on, the Bavli is much more interested in it, which is its own really interesting, fascinating development within Chazal, that you can't define everything formally when it comes to law. Sometimes we want to know what's in your kishkas.
Yeah, that's my good friend Ayala Leibson. She wrote a book that also really touches upon that, about self-knowledge and law and really seeing the difference. Of course, there are upsides to this, right, of seeing the person as autonomous, recognizing subjectivity of experience. Those are wonderful things, but they also then require more of you, which is true in real life experience.
So well said.
I actually just want to read a paragraph of something that I thought really sort of summarizes this Bavli Yerushalmi difference really well. You say that I suggested that this evolution in rabbinic thinking about ha'arama may relate to any or all of the following phenomena. A, the growing dominance of subjective intention in rabbinic thought, as you just said, also indicated in neighboring Persian cultures, both monastic Christianity and Zoroastrianism. We're not going to get into that in today's conversation, but I think it's a really important chapter as well, sort of seeing Tana'idic or Amoritic sort of thought in its cultural milieu, which is very important as well, just like my listeners are familiar with all of the episodes we've done on sort of ancient Near Eastern thinking and how that shows up in our Torah. So it's a very similar kind of discipline also in the study of rabbinic thought. The second is the general changes in rabbinic attitude towards bold counterfactual legal claims and initiatives. And C, concerns about the deterioration of observance that you also mentioned before of the law that harama might cause. And I think that that's, it's, I think, really fascinating also because we still see all of those, Ilana, sort of in our world today, meaning those are real, real ideas that I think modern poskim struggle with as well, meaning the cultural context in which we're all living, which are themselves bringing up a lot of the halacha questions in the current moment.
Yeah.
Again, not our moment, any moment. Certainly in the world we're living in today, the growing dominance of subjective intention, meaning our subjective reality or how the halachic reality is meeting our subjective reality, is something that also comes up so much. And I think that and in terms of general changes in rabbinic attitudes, well, that's something we also could see, but that takes a longer period of time to sort of be able to notice, right? We could look at rabbinic trends of thoughts, but we can't necessarily notice it in the exact moment or in one particular tshuva. Sometimes we have sort of a watershed moment where we could see change, but usually it's something that you could sort of only see sort of from a broader, sometimes even just academic perspective, in the sense of being able to look at something broadly over time. So I think that those are really important because it's not just about the Bavli and Yerushalmi then, it's also something that continues to come up now.
Totally. And something that's so interesting, and go figure how this happened, but Rabbi Daniel Feldman of Yeshiva University, we laughed. We said there must have been something in the water at Frisch. We're both Frisch graduates. We both grew up in Teaneck. He came out with a book the same month on loopholes as I did. Unbelievable. We've done an event together. It was so interesting and fun. But his Sefer focuses on like achronim.
So interesting.
Meaning I'm focused on the roots of the conversation and he's focused on the halacha l'maaseh development of some of these things. And looking at each, you see some very similar through lines, but you see the grappling with precisely the issues that you're bringing up. So I would say you want these books as companions on your shelf if this interests you.
I love that.
It's
I want to check out that book. But you know, I feel like that's a great place just jump back to the topic of bedikat. The topic of mechirat chametz, because I wanna circle back to that, because I only learned through your book, because I'm not familiar with the details of the laws themselves other than what I practically do. I learned about the fascinating history. And I just want to say, before going back in time, I just want to say currently, which is that I grew up like you. I grew up selling the chametz that I saw staring me in the face until, like, you know, my mother or father would, you know, put the brown paper that covered the shelf in the pantry. And I got married to my husband, and he was like, I don't sell actual chametz. And I was like, well, that makes a lot more sense. And then I never did again, meaning we just very consciously sort of whittle down whatever chametz we have in the house, which today in the way we eat is actually so little. It really is just sort of like maybe a bag of pasta and some bags of flour. But like, you know, we just whittle it down, and like we barely ever end up throwing anything out. And we never sell chametz gemur. So it's just like interesting, even within my own personal life, how that shifted. And that I understood that obviously one of them was, you know, a somewhat more lenient concept, and one of them was sort of more, maybe be formalistic or whatever we like to look at it. So I just want to go back into that example of mechirat chametz, because I think that it sort of can like pull out some of these different ideas that you've been discussing.
Totally. Well, first of all, we should know that Mechirat Chametz is mentioned already in the Tosefta. The Tosefta is a companion around the same time as the Mishnah. And it describes a Jew and a Gentile on a boat, and it is not the beginning of a joke. And it's almost Pesach, and the Jew says, look, take this, right? Like, take this. I can't own this Chametz now, right? And if they want, they can get it back after Pesach. But clearly that wasn't the way we do Mechirat Chametz today. That was an exigency, and it wasn't like, I'm definitely going to buy it back. And even the Tosefta right after that says, you know, a Jew can say to a non-Jew, look, why don't you buy such and such chametz for me at a higher price, because I might have to buy it back from you after Pesach anyway, right? Or I should say the Yerushalmi actually also talks about a case where somebody makes their chametz hefker within, you know, a short time before Pesach, and wondering whether that works or doesn't work. So like the beginnings of this are already in both Tanaitic literature, the Tosefta, and in the Yerushalmi, right? And Amoraic literature. But it really becomes something when Jews start owning like copious amounts of chametz. And especially in the 16th century, it's not just copious amounts of chametz, but it's copious amounts of chametz because you're involved in the brewing industry. And you have a lot of barley in your house. You can't even move it out, right? Like, as this developed, the first idea was, here you go. It has to be a sale without any conditions. And you have to move it out of your property. Jews have to move it off their property. But once you get to the 16th century, Eastern European Jews, they're not going to move the amounts of barley they have for their brewing even out of their house. So we have to even change it then. And it's just interesting to see how it moves from something that appeared to be almost like an ad hoc harama, the same way, God forbid, somebody has a house fire on Shabbos, you're stuck on a boat and this is what you're going to do because you're stuck, to, no, this is a pervasive thing that we all need. And what's interesting to me about it, it falls along a lot of the same lines. Number one, look what it's about. It's about chesron kis. It's about losing money. We don't want you to lose copious amounts. It's also, there is a machloket among, you know, I would say there are certain poskim who would say, I'm not going to sell biblical chametz. I'm not going to sell, as you say, chametz gamur. I'm not going to sell bread, because then I am trying to circumvent a biblical law of owning chametz on Pesach. But I will sell mixtures, ta'arovet chametz, where it's only a dirabanan to own it. That too is born here. Or here's a great one. The Bechor Shur, he said, you know what? I'd rather you sell your chametz, because min ha-Torah, you've already bittel chametz is good enough. And it's only mi dirabanan that you have to literally get rid of it. I'd rather you do that than, how's this, sell your animal to somebody for Pesach so that they can feed it chametz, because there is a violation min ha-Torah to get Hana'a from Chametz. So there he's also working with the Derabbanan and the Deraita. But it's some of these same arguments come up over and over again. And I have to tell you that this goes back to the trust issue and the overusing and the underusing. I live in a one-bedroom apartment. I don't have liquor. I don't collect liquor. I don't have a liquor collection. It does not cost me a lot to whittle down my chametz starting on Purim, after the day after Purim, let's be real. And we get rid of it. That's what we do. We have chametz parties in my house. We call them tashbitu parties, where you just eat your chametz. You eat your way through your chametz, and that's how you destroy it. But for people who do have a liquor cabinet and it costs money, or for people for whom what isn't a lot of money for me is a lot of money for them, that's what it's here for. That's what it's here for. I'll tell you what it's not here for, and people are going to either love that I say this, they're going to hate that I say this, is like it becoming chumrah, which is like you have no chametz, and you do mechirat chametz for the chametz that might be balua, that might be, what's the word in English that
absorbed
I'm looking for?
Absorbed or,
like,
yeah.
Absorbed, thank you. Absorbed into your pots and pans that you're not using on Pesach. That I'm sort of like, wait a second, what's going on here? Like, how did we make this from a kula into a chumrah? I think that also is sort of like, you have to really understand why you're doing certain things.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And to understand where it comes from. And I think it's not that things don't change sometimes from a chumrah to a kula or from a kula to a chumrah. These things do happen. I just want people to understand rather than just sort of make assumptions, right? Which is kind of the goal of this whole book, is to bring people into a process so that they can understand the logic of what's going on here and appreciate it. And quite frankly, feel good about it. Like, that's
so
important.
I'm really happy. You touched upon two things that I was curious about. One is that, why am I still signing a piece of paper selling my chametz if I'm so careful not to have any chametz? Meaning I think that, yeah, that this maybe needs to be the end of that. But I guess my last question I sort of wanted to end with, which you kind of already, maybe you touched upon it now, is sort of for you, what you feel is, you know, this is, on one hand, it's an academic book and you worked on it in an academic context. But I know that you're also always after the meaning that is behind all of your scholarship. And so I guess my question is sort of, what do you feel that this, what do you feel is sort of your biggest contribution with this book to the conversation? And in the fancy terms, I'm say, like, you know, what's your chiddush, you know? But I feel like in one piece you already sort of offered just now, which is that you really want to show people the richness and sort of the roots of these conversations. I'm curious if anything else comes up for you when I ask the question more directly.
Sure. I would say like this. I truly believe that halacha is a language of love between the Kadosh Baruch Hu and the Jewish people. And I truly believe that loopholing is the way that Chazal serve as lawyers to try to negotiate between when, you know, Anochi Hashem Elokecha means I say jump, you say how high, and when Anochi Hashem Elokecha means I want to make sure that you can live. And I find that people sometimes forget, and a lot of times it's because we live in a Western, I'm going to say for myself, living in America, we're living in a Western Christian Protestant approach to things where love is love and law can't be love. And I just don't think that's true. I think that for Chazal, actually having a way to carefully navigate these things and serve their client, the Jewish people, in front of the judge, the Kadosh Baruch Hu, it's very enduring. It's very enduring. And that is something that I want people to see and to appreciate. The attempt to have an enduring dialogue between God and the Jewish people. And I think law is actually the only way to do that.
Alana, thank you so much for being here today and sharing the fruits
Thank
of your
you.
Labors and moving us, inspiring us, and also informing us. It's always such a great feat when all three of those can be accomplished at the same time. So thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for coming to the wedding of my child. And I wish everybody a chag kasher v'sameach, whether they're selling their chametz, not selling their chametz, selling their chametz l'chumra, not selling full chametz, whatever you're doing, May it bring you much joy, much meaning, much inspiration. Thank you so, so much for having me, Yosefa, and for all the things you do.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode from Matan Women's Institute for Torah Study. If you would like to sponsor an episode, please contact the Matan office or email me at podcast@matan.org.il. Please do us and all women's Torah learning a favor and share this episode with all of your friends and family.